This is Angle of View. Today is April 28th, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. Angle of View Classics Week 2. Good to great movies about art and artists. Let's go. The Fabelmans, 2022, directed by Steven Spielberg. Review date, September 28th, 2024. Second viewing. The Fabelmans makes artists look like the compulsives that they are without asking you to pity them. It makes them look like the mystics they are without asking you to worship them. It demonstrates the ordinary toil that art practices demand without asking you to be impressed by it. It shows you where artists get their inspiration from without explaining everything away. It shows both edges of the art life sword, how art demands that the artist gather their life into something expressible while requiring that they detach from that life in order to do it. An artist who starts as a child will be pained more than anyone by this cost for the way it distorts and sometimes reduces the social experiences, both in family and among peers, that are so vital to child development and that the child wants to have. Their friends and family will either not understand what they do or why they do it, or they will love what they do but be pained at having to share them with it. The Fabelmans draws pictures of all these traps with amazing care and tenderness, while stepping nimbly around all the many traps set out for it. And the fact that it's a film about an artist whose medium is film opens it to that rare meta-narrative level of engagement that actually intensifies your emotional appreciation. Besides the delight of warm hug jokes like the adjustment of the final shot, and when Sammy says, "Unless I make a movie about it someday," there's, e.g., the immense pathos added to the scene of Sammy imagining in the moment how he would shoot the scene of his parents' divorce announcement that is achieved when you think about the real Spielberg imagining how to shoot all of it. The idea of film as Spielberg's personal language, the only way he can really express himself, is what creates all the most powerful connections both within the film and through it. An example of the former is Michelle Williams' abject crawl out of the closet after she has watched Sammy's film of her betrayal. And for the latter, we have the immense shadow cast behind Paul Dano in his one good performance ever as he feels himself vanish while staring at that cookout photo. These are the moments that make Spielberg's intentions clearest. The movie is as complex and spiky as the experience of growing up, but because he needed to break away from his family in order to become the artist he was born to be, he is compelled to return now as that artist, in his language, to press his parents and his sisters close to his heart. Call it a love letter to movies, I wouldn't say you were wrong. But it's at least as beautiful as an overdue thank you card to his family for giving him the inspiration, both warm and cold, to make movies, as well as the means, both generous and grudging, and then finally letting him go off and make them. The title, after all, is not Sammy. Inside Llewyn Davis, 2013, directed by Joel and Ethan Coen. Review date, December 21st, 2024. Second viewing. The agonies of being a middling talent, of being just good enough that you convinced yourself to keep trying, and of ultimately discovering after many sunk costs the distance between your feeling that you were put on this earth to be an artist and those of everyone else. The movie itself even seems at first to believe that Llewyn is great and destined. Its gaze toward him is nothing short of adoring when he performs, but it's just the desperation of his ego rubbing off on the frame. You can't deny that there's something missing during his performances. He gets 3 uninterrupted songs, 4 if you count Please Mr. Kennedy, and numerous littler moments. The camera gives him all the support it possibly can, and still it's just not happening. There's no magic. It's not simply a matter of him not fitting into Bud Grossman's commercial idea of what a performer should be. He's a dull performer, pretty and tame. And that duo he had with his more talented dead friend was his best shot. He knows it, too. He knows his mediocrity is the main reason that the national folk music discovery phenomenon currently in progress is passing him over. And he pontificates about integrity and lashes out at his fellows to soothe his wounded pride whenever he gets a fresh taste of his insubstantiality. He does this even though he desires recognition and the material rewards that come with it just as much as any of those supposed posers. And this frustration is what's driving his anger. And he is bitterly aware of the hypocrisy which only wounds his pride further. These conflicts are just intolerable, and the grisly experience of reckoning with them fills him with shame. The saddest line in this very sad movie is, "I thought I just needed a night's sleep, but it's more than that." Most artists aren't as socially inept and mean as Llewyn Davis, nor probably as unlucky. But in socioeconomic as well as psychological terms, the lived experience of probably about 90% of artists is something like this. And of course, these are precisely the people you don't hear about unless you know or are one yourself. Possibly only the Coens would think this story was worth telling, just as only they would manage to give Llewyn the full measure of his humanity without even grazing the temptation to candy him up so that you'll like him. I don't know if any other filmmakers of their generation had a greater gift for characterization. And the fact that Inside Llewyn Davis is short on the butter and sugar of their most beloved movies, plot, violence, broad humor, only makes the amazingly subtle, textured development of the main character more perceptible. It's like a perfect charcoal drawing. It's on that strength, which extends through to Oscar Isaac's bilious double-knotted performance, that incredibly it's not just as moving but as entertaining as any of their bigger movies. Pollock, 2000, directed by Ed Harris. Review date December 17th, 2023. Second viewing. Pollock is most marvelous as an actor's showcase, but it's one of those rare actor's showcases which, after distinguishing itself as such by being its lead actor's first directing credit, actually satisfies as a well-directed movie. Harris is truly hard-edged in how he pushes this exquisite and delicately arranged cast. He's treating beautiful sculptures like action figures, and none more toughly than himself. And it pays off. It's glorious work from everyone. Marcia Gay Harden's performance is probably one of the least actually seen performances ever to win an Academy Award, and it's because those who did see it could not shake it off. I laughed when this was first released, and before I had seen it, because it seemed like Harris might plausibly have chosen his subject by asking himself what historical figure he physically resembled the most strongly, and simply going from there. But besides how risible it would be for anybody to take that approach to anything, the paintings themselves are so central to the story that nobody lacking in real love for the work could have made the movie. In fact, it seems that a desire to investigate the paintings on film, more so than the man who made them, was the actual primary motivation, which is the correct spirit. The bottomless eternity held in those paintings is why we care. They are treated with the right note of curiosity, just enough to leaven the reverence. The primal power is felt on the canvas, and we are meant to feel it spill over into the scenes, and the real trick is that it manages to create that feeling of spillage while delicately sidestepping the worst of the stormy artist biopic banalities, namely the suggestion that artistic genius is a force which cannot help but cause suffering to the people in the artist's life, that emotional abusiveness is the other side of the creativity coin. This movie sees Jackson Pollock's abuse as primarily a product of his alcoholism, and his alcoholism as a mysterious condition with no definitive source, which is just how it really is in life. There is never a suggestion that his paintings depended on his booze or his cruelty. If anything, it's the opposite. He paints his best when clean. And the movie never lets him off the hook for the many steps he took near the end to increase his investment in booze and cruelty at the cost of painting. It's not easy to hold all these elements and avoid cliché. There are a few of the kinds of pat, conveniently crystalline convergence moments that biopics can't resist putting in, e.g. the discovery of the drip and Lee Krasner's extemporaneous lecture on cubism. But apart from that, it doesn't give that annoying feeling of hitting the expected beat at the expected rhythm. We have an unusually good laconic screenplay, as such things go, from Barbara Turner and Susan Emshwiller to thank for this. But also Harris has a clear-headed film sense. It may not be visionary, but it's extremely firm. He's got serious talent surrounding him. Lisa Rinsler's lighting is consistently magnificent and thrummingly dramatic, no matter the setting. But his grasps of the shot and of editing rhythms are absolutely there. He clearly paid attention on set, and on stage before that. A lot of his presentation choices are theater-derived and totally digestible because the editing integrates them so well. It's not all great. Jeff Beal's score is a blight, nowhere near close to the core instability of the story, and I don't know where that GeoCities typeface in the credits came from. The first 90 seconds are nothing but that typeface and that music, and you wonder if you're being pranked. Also, more seriously, a few of the scenes, the concluding car crash, the Thanksgiving table flip before it, and an ill-advised dolly zoom so conspicuous that you'll absolutely know it when you see it, are simply overdone, Harris having squeezed the elements too hard. Just as Pollock did? Too passionate to be contained? Huh? Things just can't help but get soppy after that much sustained release. As is typical of drama, it's when it's partly holding itself in that it's punching the hardest. Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, 1985, directed by Paul Schrader. Review date September 14th, 2024, second viewing. It's always risky to make a biopic about an artist, for the reason that you will be expected to connect the substance of the artist's life with the substance of their work somehow, and this requirement invites you into a minefield. A movie that avoids the responsibility will be considered incurious, and rightly so, but 9 out of every 10 that take it on will make connections too few, too obvious, too simplistic, or too inflated, and risk being called reductive. Paul Schrader, in this movie so unlike any of his others, yet so like them at the same time, gets somewhere with Yukio Mishima by slotting dramatizations of some of his major works in with reenactments of some of his life's major episodes, and, in order to make the choice resonate, cutting the story of his life unapologetically down to the few ideas that were in charge at the end. You can cite this as a case of the work calling itself reductive before anyone else can, but it vibrates so furiously in its tight little container that it comes off more like a necessary winnowing, sage and possibly brilliant. Rather than trying to capture the whole man, it's capturing the legend, the persona. And actually, of that, it's concerned principally with a certain chunk, the story of the artist who became increasingly obsessed with the limitations of art's expressive power, at the same time as both his art and his life began to narrow toward a reactionary traditionalist politics. This is the aspect of the Mishima legend that got Paul Schrader's gears turning. He's always been magnetized by stories of repressed men who finally seek to purify themselves with violence. And the fact of Mishima's philosophical narrowness at the end of his life invites a narrower movie by begging for an understanding of how that narrowing occurred. It's a precious match of artist, subject, and form. Moreover, the dramatizations being so self-aware as such, embracing theater conventions, and being filmed in oversaturated color with Philip Glass arpeggios trilling high and ecstatic in the mix, insists that you make the connections poetically, even sensually, rather than intellectually. Benediction, 2022, directed by Terrence Davies. Review date December 8th, 2022. First and only viewing. An exquisitely languid and intimate portrait of a good man, poet Siegfried Sassoon, bent into permanent anger by two unjust forces. The dehumanizing brutality of World War I, which gave him scars in his youth that he kept forever, and Britain's criminalization of homosexuality, which robbed him of any chance at true personal peace once that first horror had passed. It's a shame that this was my first Davies, not only because it means that I lacked that access of context for assessing this one, but because it's clear I've been missing out on a very special artist. Note, I have caught up on some past Davies since this date, and they're all really good. And he's died since then. R.I.P. His talent for writing dialogue is exceeded only by his talent for directing it. The words almost certainly sparkle on the page, but they positively burst into flames on camera for the way Davies paces their delivery and modulates the actor's pitch and volume. It's amazing that he doesn't have a theater background, as it's been years since I watched an original dramatic film that demonstrated such a mastery of speech. Every two-person scene in particular was thrummingly alive, no matter the emotional tenor, and this movie touches them all. Naturally, the actors deserve enormous credit for this, too. Many of them I'd never had the pleasure of watching before, and they all swept me away, especially Jack Loudon, our choleric, stultified lead, who seems in every scene like he's trying to hold his breath to keep from drowning. It would appear from interviews that Davies saw a lot of himself in Sassoon, and I certainly think that only someone of similar temperament could have done justice to his. I'm particularly reminded of the way Sassoon in the film takes exception to all the praise he receives, but especially to the idea that he is courageous, and the rather stunning courage of Davies' directorial approach here, in which he lets scenes go far longer than a conventional American production would allow, because he knows the power of slowness. And he does 100 unfashionable things, dissolves, voiceover, splicing in old news footage, because he trusts their power. The sequences of pure image underscored by readings of Sassoon's poems or by music separate the movie's dramatic scenes the way dreams separate days. Davies is rewarded for every choice. It's just wonderful. Irma Vep, 1996, directed by Olivier Assayas. Review date April 23rd, 2023. First and only viewing. Few movies about movie making cradle you like this one does in the fever dream that the people involved are sharing. Between this and Shadow of the Vampire, there's a case to be made that the best movies about making movies are the ones that most potently translate the madness of ambition that it takes to do something so insane, and make you understand that every time a movie actually gets completed and released, it's a miracle. Assayas achieves one of the most intuitive and grounded naturalistic styles I've ever seen. It's almost all tight rooms, the camera close to everyone because there is no way to back up, and the effect is that the camera eye is like that of a curious ghost haunting the film production, smoothly slipping around and in between everyone to catch every last little thing, of which there are so wonderfully many, what with how thoughtful the actors are about the details of their performances. The relationships in the movie are beautifully drawn, revealing that summer camp meets wartime vibe of people who don't know each other, thrown together in a hurry, and forced to collaborate in support of a unified artistic vision. The energy of all these scenes on set is spot on, and Assayas's close framings lend just the right feeling of pressurized intimacy. By natural extension, all the questions the movie raises about art and commerce, the hellish crossroads that motion pictures have always called home, come across with just the right touch because they're not emphasized and backlit in the plot situations. They're instead just there, by necessity, at the heart of all the characters' neuroses, and they come out in jagged, anxious bursts during all the little fights and laughing fits and moments of quiet, the way all feelings do when you're trying to hold them in so that you can get through your work day. Maggie Cheung is simply a stunning presence. It's adorable that Renee, the director of the film within the film, chose the project entirely as a pretext to let the camera worship her for 90 minutes, and that's pretty much exactly what Assayas did, too. Vanya on 42nd Street, 1994, directed by Louis Malle. Review date August 19th, 2025. Second viewing. Among the best attempts ever made to invade a theatrical production with a movie camera, partly because the Andre Gregory Wallace Shawn workshop conception here lent itself so beautifully to intimacy, partly because it turned out that Chekhov's text throbs twice as hard when it's executed at such a short distance, and partly because Malle made every camera choice count for as much as it possibly could within these premises. It's a thing of beauty right from the start, the wonder of following the actors off the teeming street and into this busted palace and watching the play just melt into being, the derelict theater with crumbling ceiling offering itself up so humbly as Chekhov's setting, the line of its beginning so soft and fuzzy that anyone who didn't know Uncle Vanya might not realize it had begun until the reverse shot of the audience. It's marvelous that the actors complain about being tired when they're filing in. They couldn't be more perfectly prepared. Wallace Shawn lies down on a bench before you've found out what role he's playing, so it isn't obvious that he's taken his place. For all you know, he might just be getting in a few winks. It's probably a deliberate joke, and it's a good one. It's enchantment with drama of the special variety that, as in Renoir's The Golden Coach, can only be achieved when the frames hung around artifice, the containers of performance, are acknowledged and celebrated. Your knowledge that they're only actors makes what they're doing all the more beautiful. It is their task and their training to perform emotions on command, but an actor's emotions are tapped, not faked. You're not pretending to cry when the tears in your eyes are real. It's for our sake that they do this. It's to activate our feelings. And short of doing it yourself, only a movie that offers this kind of closeness can awaken you to this understanding of the tender sacrifice of acting. Every performer is uniquely splendid, each filled to the top with their character's own perverse dignity. But the two women in the lead cast, Brooke Smith and Julianne Moore, are especially magnificent. Smith doing Sonia as a bruise larger than the size of her body, and Moore doing Yelena like a doll that has been broken and repaired to a state of new fragility. The two women of totally different circumstances, with lives of totally different shapes, who are united in starvation. Both of them forever a second away from screaming or from shutting down for good. Their scenes together are thunderingly alive. But Malle animates everything, and I mean in the divine sense. Not just the physical closeness, but the constancy of handheld, with the frame wobbling and tilting ever so slightly, ever so often, makes the camera not an objective eye, but a breathing, chuckling, sighing observer. A whole extra person, not watching, but involved. Equally extraordinary are the moments when we get a close-up of a character who is not speaking, someone we might have been content to ignore in favor of the speaker, but who, because this cast is so special, is fully engaged in their character's reaction. Maul pulls us into their listening ears, something the theater could not do without overblown effects like spots. The effect is never not moving, and is frequently the thing that takes a scene to its saddest place. I was on the verge of tears this entire viewing and never got my release. That's exactly how you're supposed to feel coming out of Uncle Vanya. Nobody said life was a rose garden. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.